All right, this is long overdue. In fact, the title of the email that I sent to this guest asking him to come on the show somewhat sheepishly was long overdue follow-up pod, because lots of people have been asking for this. At the time when he was doing his greatest of all time rankings, he only had done up until the top eight, and we were going to have him on again, and then the playoffs started and it was a truncated offseason for me with the wedding, but he's been kind enough to wait until now. Ben Taylor, how you doing, man?
Good to be back. I'm worried I set the bar too high in the first go around. So yeah, a lot to live up to today, I think.
So you thought your pod was that good, huh?
No, I didn't. It was just the feedback. I was like, oh man, what have I done?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what you did was leaving them wanting more by not having done those top eight. So let me see here. Where do we want to start? I think I want to, before we get into those top eight, and those who have read his series on backpicks.com know it already, but we will get to that to be sure. But I wanted to start again, and we talked about this a little bit the first time, but it might be good since it's been about 6 months now, to just talk about what your methodology was. And if you want to really get into it, we talked about it more the first time, but he does a lot of plus minus work and stuff that really hadn't been available before, especially for the guys who were the pre-Databall era, as he calls it. 1997 is the first year we have plus minus data, but Ben goes back and is able to estimate that from earlier on. But would an accurate summary of kind of your criteria, maybe rather than your method, be if you started this guy's career the same year he came into the league, but he had average teammates around him for his career, how many championships would you expect him to win? And then basically you're ranking him on that criteria. Is that a fair summary, or is that too simple?
No, almost. I think the only thing to adjust there is that it's not just average teammates. So, interestingly, when I started the process years ago of like thinking about it from this perspective, the first calculations I did were with average teammates. And at a certain point, I got around when I sort of developed the full like core, that is championships over replacement player. I said, okay, you have to look at how guys affect different teams, right? Because players aren't just being slotted on 500 clubs and then making them contenders or whatnot. So you look at the whole distribution of teams, and some guys that means are going to be on really good teams, some guys are going to be on poor teams. And from that, essentially, I say, what's the championship odds on a random team? And we can quibble about, we can quibble about like how random it is, right? Because after a while, you can argue, well, it's not that random because they're going to try to build around the player. Yeah, but that was the idea.
Well, and I guess that's interesting too, because if you say average, random probably is a better way of saying it. But in some ways, it doesn't really matter maybe what your performance would be with average teammates, because there's just about
Right.
nobody in average NBA history who, with average teammates, is going to win a championship. And if all we're
Exactly.
talking about is, hey, if what are your chances of winning a championship? So really, the better question, and this is one that you've done pioneering work on, is, all right, if you have good teammates, how good are you, right? How good is your team?
Right, right.
And so that really seems like more what the inquiry is at this point.
Right. And that's where the concept of portability, or how well a guy's skills scale up as the team gets better, that's where that became such a critical issue. Because to your point, you almost essentially never win a title with poor teammates. It just doesn't happen. Okay or average teammates, every once in a blue moon, you'll have a 2003 Tim Duncan or something. And they had a pretty good cast in terms of defense and role players. But in
Yeah,
general,
and they also had a pretty lucky run that year too, with
yes.
Chris Webber getting hurt, Dirk Nowitzki getting hurt.
Right. I mean, there's just only a few instances in the last 30 or 40 years of teams of that quality winning. So to your point, it rarely happens. And instead, it's like, okay, how's your value going to be maintained as you play on better and better teams? And that's really where the power of that idea came from. It was looking at these distributions and saying like, okay, wait a second, you can be the greatest floor raiser ever, but you're still not getting close to winning a title. So yeah, that's the idea.
Yeah, and that's a concept that I think I had articulated intuitively on the show going back a couple of years. I talked about DeMarcus Cousins, for example, is a guy who can get you from 25 to 40 wins or 20 to 35 wins, but because of his usage and because of, you know, he can get you from being the 25th best offense to the 15th best offense, but because of his defensive limitations, his usage, his turnovers, at that time he wasn't really as good of a shooter outside, so he probably didn't fit as well with other players. You really wonder about whether he could be a guy who would help. And that's actually part of why I don't think he's going to help Golden State that much this year, because he kind of provides a weak link to attack defensively. But, you know, those are some of the questions that you come into. And then, you know, you have things like, how well does he shoot when he's off the ball? How well does he defend? You know, is he going to take away from others because you don't have to guard him when he doesn't have the ball in his hands? Questions like that really, I think, play into your list. And it's one of the first lists I've seen. I mean, the only one that takes those into account.
Right.
Yeah. And the next thing I wanted to talk about too here is the idea of longevity versus peak. That's something that we've been discussing a lot. Kevin Pelton and Royce Webb, when I had them on a couple of years ago, we talked about that and how you weighed it. And it seems like one of your thoughts here is that longevity may be just underrated in these discussions.
Yeah, I think generally the sort of rubrics we come up with intuitively to structure these things really shoot down longevity. I discuss it in the series post-mortem, sort of balancing some of the traditional views. And then when you actually start to lay out like where this value comes from, I think one of the easiest ways to see it is with these guys that play forever, Reggie Miller, John Stockton, Kareem, whatever. And it's like, yeah, there's still all-star level players at the end of their career. When they retire, the team gets worse because you can't just automatically replace an all-star or even a sub-all-star, right? And I think that's where it gets lost in the shuffle, is there's something in the way we want to simplify and kind of think about these players historically that allows us to say, okay, I'm only going to look at like his best 5 years or his 8 year prime. I've heard people say, I don't care about seasons where you're not an all NBA player. And when you do that, you really, really start to minimize longevity, on top of the fact that we may kind of, even when we think about it, underrated intuitively. I think that's a lot of my research has led me to a place where it's like, man, it's hard to provide value for that 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th, et cetera, year.
Yeah. And maybe there's almost this feeling in our minds, which probably is not rational, that because those guys who play for so long, you know, Malone would be another guy there. We'll see where LeBron ends up. Those guys who play for so long are outliers. It's almost like it's unfair to compare them to sort of the more normal player who is going to have maybe 10 great seasons.
Right.
So I think it's like, well, we don't really know how to do this. These guys don't really fit into the mold. And so, all right, we're just going to not really count those extra seasons, and we'll just compare their best 10 seasons to these other guys' best 10 seasons.
Right. And I don't want to get too philosophical, as I've known to do, but I think you're hitting at, right, you're hitting at this thing where it's like different people have different criteria, but they don't explicitly state it. And that's a very human nature thing. It's not our job always to perfectly articulate our own criteria. But I think at the end of the day, people are comparing, doing a little bit of apples and oranges comparison sometimes, where it's like someone, when they talk about the greatest ever, really does only mean at his best for some sustained period. And I think I bring this up at the end of the series in like this idea of an 8 year rule or something like that. It's like, I care about how good you are when you are at your best, but it can't be a fluke. And after that, everything else is a wash.
Yeah, you need enough seasons to kind of cement yourself into the consciousness. And then, of course, there's also the bias of, well, you have to have really been in playoff contention, in the finals, ideally winning championships, to sort of, again, cement that impression into people's heads in a way that, you know, someone that we're going to talk a lot about today is Kevin Garnett. And, you know, he just wasn't there. You know, it was really only three seasons really in which he was in the conference finals or better in his career at his highest level, and maybe even only two seasons, 08 and 04 there. So, you know, it becomes more difficult. Now, one thing that you also articulated in that kind of wrap up, which to me seems a little bit at loggerheads with the idea of the longevity, is this kind of exponential curve for great seasons, that, you know, if you, and I forget the exact name that you have, just, but, you know, if you're going to say, hey, here's a guy who adds, you know, 8 points per game to your team, which would be, know, just an unbelievable, like, all-time great season, that having a guy like that versus having a guy who adds 5 points per game to your team, the guy who's adding 8 points per game to your team, it's not a linear relationship with how likely you are to win a championship, from 5 to 8, that you're much more likely if you have that 8 player than if you have that 5 player.
Right. It's funny you pick 5 and 8. I think off the top of my head, 5 and 8 are closer to double in distance. So 5 is like near 18 or 20%, and 8 starts to get into like the high 30s.
Yeah. And that's your chance of winning a championship in a given year if you have
on a random player. Yes. On a random team. Exactly. It's they're at odds, but they automatically balance each other. There's no sort of philosophical weighting that needs to take place. It's like, well, in this particular set of criteria, 5 seasons of Reggie Miller equals 1 peak Bill Walton season, or whatever it comes out to.
Well, and also I think it does what you just said about your chances of winning a championship in a given year. I mean, so 8 basically, I mean, that'd be, you know, your best That's ever best. Michael Jordan season, yeah. You know, your 09 LeBron James, you know, maybe an early Kareem year or something like that. And even then, you only have a 40% chance of winning a championship in a given year with, you know, one of the 5 best seasons of all time. You know, I think that's really important for this analysis, for the people who, you know, obviously people on NBA Twitter dismiss the whole, oh, rings, that's all that matters idea. But that's important to note that, you know, even if you are playing at the greatest of all time level in an individual season, you probably, if you're playing on a random team with random teammates, only have about a 40% chance of winning a championship in that season. And if you're playing at a level which, you know, that +5 level, which is probably what, maybe there's 40 seasons like that ever, is that accurate? Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, certainly probably more seasons, probably 20, I want to say 20 or 25 guys, I think, who probably have a peak in that range, and then some of them have multiple seasons, of course.
Yeah, okay, so maybe there's 60 of those seasons or so. But then, you know, the 60 greatest seasons in NBA history, you only have a 20% chance of winning the championship if you've got one of those guys on your team with random talents.
Forty's on the high side. I think the highest season I ended up with was in the low 30s, and we'll obviously talk about who that is if we get to him. But you know, it's there's some, you know, there's a range, basically. Let's put it that way. I can't dogmatically say like the best season ever is 33.2% or something, but it's in that range, 30 to 35%. And if you're a little more liberal, or someone was better than I give them credit for, or something like that, you could be closer to 40. But I think the take home that you're trying to make, especially with the rings crowd, is that you can't just, there used to be a saying when we were growing up, right? Like Michael Jordan, you could put him on any team and win a title. And the evidence for that is any overwhelmingly team except- no. Except half the Eastern Conference and the bottom 6 teams in the West.
And the 1985 through 1990 Chicago Bulls.
Yeah. Well played. Very well played. One last note on rings, and I was remiss not to, I had a little section in my book, Thinking Basketball on Rings, and I was remiss to leave this out. I think rings would be a fantastic scientific measurement in terms of methodology if they ran the season like 100,000 times.
Oh, sure.
And they shuffled all the lineups. I think then if you had like one single metric that you wanted to hone in on, rings would tell you what you want to know. But because there's only one year and so few combinations, like the guys we're going to talk about today played with so few combinations of teammates, so you're kind of locked in, and rings doesn't really tell you much.
All right, we got a lot more to get here with Ben, and we're going to do a home and home. So when I go on his show, we can talk about more of some of these philosophical things, but we got to get to that top 8, and we will do so right after this.
I think it's been maybe like 20 years or so that bars have been popular, but I'd never really been a huge fan of them because you just don't know what they are. You don't know what you're getting, and they don't really taste that great either. But RX Bar now has changed the game by actually listing their ingredients right on the front of the packaging. And guess what? When you list your ingredients, you're going to do that with natural ingredients. And they use egg whites for protein. They use dates to bind, nuts for texture, and other delicious ingredients like unsweetened chocolate, real fruit, spices like sea salt or cinnamon. They're up to 14 flavors now: mango, pineapple, chocolate chip, peanut butter, other seasonal flavors. They are gluten-free, soy-free, and free of artificial flavors and preservatives. If you want a breakfast on the go, pre-workout snack, or a little pick-me-up during those dog days at the office in the afternoon. They also just debuted a new RX nut butter as well. It's a single serve packet and it's got delicious creamy nut butter, 9 grams of protein, and it comes in 3 flavors, honey cinnamon peanut butter, and vanilla almond butter. Squeezable and spreadable and pairs great with fruit, rice cakes, pretzels, or straight out of the pouch as well. It's definitely the best tasting of these bars that I have had. And you can feel good about it because it's all natural ingredients, no preservatives. And if you want to get started with them, go to the site RxBar, that's the letter R, the letter X, rxbar.com/capspace, easy to remember capspace, we talk about it all the time on the program. They'll get you 25% off your first order. That's rxbar.com/capspace, and make sure you enter the promo code capspace at checkout. rxbar.com/capspace, enter that promo code capspace at checkout, let them know that you came from us. All right, so number 8 on Ben's list is, obviously we didn't talk about him last time, is a player who I think would be much lower for most people. Pretty much any other list that I've seen has this guy, probably the highest would be like 13th or 14th, and that's Kevin Garnett. So I'll give you the floor here to talk about why it is that you have him higher than anyone else when you consider that really, as we just talked about, when he was the engine of his team, there were really only had 2 conference finals appearances, 04 and 08.
I noticed you left out 2012 as a conference finals appearance as well.
And 2010 for that matter, yeah. Because I felt like by that point, offensively, he just, was not anywhere. After that injury in 09, he really just was nowhere near the same as an offensive player, though certainly defensively he was awesome. But maybe that's something else we'll talk about too, is that a lot of people underrate defense. But I assume that's reason number one, maybe, because he is one of the greatest defensive players of all time.
Right. Yeah. I think there, and I've talked about this in the series, there's a tendency to underrate defense historically. He's one of the greatest defensive players ever. I think, let me take a step back. Why is he so underrated from this perspective? Why do I have him so much higher than sort of the traditional conventional approach? I would say that if we were to go in a time machine, go back 30 years to 1988, it's the dawn of unrestricted free agency. We're going to say, okay, the league is going to add a bunch more teams and it's going to get international. We're going to add a bunch of players and expand the talent pool. What would a guy look like? What would be the criteria if we could go into that chemistry lab for a guy to be a great player, but be totally unrecognized as being a great player? I would say, okay, number one, he would have to play in a small market. The free agency rules would have to deter anyone from going to said small market. He would, as a player, excel in traditionally unmeasured areas like defense and, I don't know, passing or big man playmaking. He would not be a 30-point per game scorer who jacks shots relentlessly. And he would need to be in a terrible team situation filled with front office ineptitude. Maybe one of his teammates dies tragically. And if he has any all-star teammates, they have devastating injuries that end their career. But does that sound like a fair prognostication for said player?
Yeah, and maybe also they lose 4 out of 5 first round draft picks due to league action with the Joe Smith saga,
right,
as well, right?
Right.
I mean, maybe that was a little too specific for your construct there, but nonetheless, yeah, that's a great way to put it,
and I think that's the short of it. I think he checks every box for having this wild discrepancy between, and then of course to answer your original question, what makes him great? A phenomenal passer, one of the greatest defenders ever, a versatile defender. I think I called him a T-cell. Watching him on film, he's got this motor, and I think the motor is underrated in terms of just how much energy he exerts while he's on the court, especially defensively. And he was a good scorer. So you have this guy who's a great balance between a good offensive player, great defensive player. He's got the longevity. I mean, people just overlook the traditional stuff with him because of all of the things I just mentioned with the team losing and the first round and missing the playoffs. And they overlook, like, the guy made 15 all-star teams. He's one of the only players ever to have defensive player of the year, most valuable player. He's got a bunch more things. I think he's got an all-star game MVP. The list goes on and on in terms of the credentials, like 25,000 points, X number of thousands of assists and rebounds. He's one of the only guys in that club. So yeah, it's just an incredible career.
Well, and also, I mean, this isn't really part of what you're
discussion is, but a guy who really could have been really good in any era. Like in this era, he could have been just an incredible center. He probably would have gotten his range out to the three-point line, which for whatever reason he never did. I think perhaps due to stubbornness. You know, Tim Bontemps talks about how he used to drain threes during his Nets days, you know, in warmups, but just would never shoot him. And you know, also just his scalability is awesome, right? I mean, because you can, there are some guys you could say, oh, you know, he had no talent around them, but look what he did. He pushed this Minnesota team up to 50 wins, you know, but maybe that's just your classic floor raiser, as you would say. But KG clearly, as he showed in Boston, and then just if you look at his skill set, being a good passer, being an excellent shooter, obviously a great defensive player, being a guy who doesn't really have any weaknesses. I mean, I think that's a big part of being, you know, a scalable player. He could fit in if he had just not gotten such a terrible draw in terms of his teammates. When it did come time to scale, he would have been awesome there too, had he had different teammates.
Well, it's interesting. He was developing a three-point shot. The other thing is he came into the league so young.
Right.
And he was an all-star in his second year at 19 to 20 years old. And he was developing a three, and he moved away from the three and just instead for the era became a pick-and-pop or spacing long two-point shooter. And for the metrics that we have going back over 20 years now, one of the best outside shooting big men ever, you know, in the 80 percentile for free throws. I forget where his career free throw percentage ended up, but a very just really good shooter. Yeah, when you think about translating error, which isn't really my thing, it's like not hard to imagine that he could have a three-point shot and extend that jumper out another foot or two. Go ahead.
Yeah, there was a time I remember. I think they played like some preseason games in Japan.
Yes.
You remember this? Like it was the first games. He was like bombing threes. Like people like, oh shit, he's gonna like KG's getting a three now, and then he just never shot him again. Basically, after that,
I think it was 99. I think it was after the lockout season. That was really when he was sort of put on my radar as a guy who was like, okay, this guy is getting really, really good. And yeah, he was shooting threes in those games and then just went away from it. But I wanted to get to something else that you mentioned, which one of the biggest pieces of evidence for Garnett to me is what happened when he went to Boston.
Oh yeah.
Because, and I speak about this in his profile, his value. So just to level set for those who aren't aware, he's got really, really good box score stats. But then when you look at the plus minus stats, he's arguably the king. LeBron has put up really the only guy who's put up better numbers in the last 20 something years. And he does very well across the board, depending on how you triangulate his value. And so he did this in 2003 in Minnesota with that team. 2004, they flipped the roster around a little bit. They bring in Sam Cassell and Latrell Sprewell on his last legs, even though he's still a big name. They get Irvin Johnson and Hassel to play big minutes as defensive fillers, and they kind of have a more balanced roster. Well, again, there's a number of guys, I know private metrics that I've heard people talk about, they have 2004 as the best season ever. There's a lot of plus minus studies that have 2004 as the best season ever. By ever, I mean 20 something years that we have on record.
Yeah.
And then his numbers are still very good in Minnesota, but he goes to Boston and he kind of does it again with a totally new team. And the shocking thing to me, and this is where you get into this scalability idea, is he does it when there are concerns about, oh, there's only one ball. And it's like Pierce, yeah, Allen, all these other players, it didn't matter. He just fit right in, put out one of the best defensive seasons ever. And so he's got this history of doing it in different environments. And that's really, really important to me. Really impressive.
Yeah. And obviously he had a rotating cast around him in his early days in Minnesota. I think the biggest criticism of KG is, to me, is could he be the engine? You know, if he is your best offensive player, are you going to have like a great offense? Even those Boston teams, I think that 08 team, you know, and granted they had like Rondo out there, you know, who was not a good offense player, certainly at that time, and I think has always been overrated, and Kendrick Perkins, you know, I mean, those are two guys in the starting lineup who are not going to help you much. But, you know, I can't remember where the offensive rankings were of some of those Minnesota teams. I'm guessing probably the 04 team was really good. But generally, like if he's your number one guy, are you gonna, does he make a great offense by himself the way some of these other guys in NBA history do? But of course he does plenty of the other stuff too. I mean, you can make the argument that, you know, at least in terms of offense, he's better on a great team as kind of a second banana, but he's certainly a first banana defensively. And I think another point that you've made too is that, you know, especially as guys get into the back ends of your career, it's kind of hard to find those second bananas. Those second bananas can add a lot to your championships, because if you have a first banana, you're not necessarily going to be able to win a championship unless you have those other guys around them. And finding your Kevin Garnett, or a Draymond Green or a Klay Thompson, KG is obviously way better than those guys, but that's finding that specific mold of player who goes with your first banana can almost be as difficult at times.
We're in, I think, total agreement on this one. I think Garnett, if you have him as your best offensive player, you shouldn't expect a phenomenal offense. You'll get a good offense, and that's what the evidence shows on his teams. But you ideally, if you want to build a juggernaut, you want a guy who's going to be a primary offensive engine. Have Garnett as your secondary guy, and then that carry, especially those post prime seasons. It's like, yeah, having post prime Kevin Garnett as your second or third best offensive player, that's a really good situation.
Well, speaking of really good situations, let's move to Tim Duncan, who was in many ways, other than the small market, kind of the opposite. He was gestated into this amazing situation in San Antonio. Certainly he deserved a ton of credit, and you could say that San Antonio was probably luckier to have him than he was to have San Antonio. But nonetheless, he comes in, he's winning, I think, 56 games immediately. He's got David Robinson, who, you know, I think was 15th on your list, as I recall, and, you know, was still playing at a level probably higher than people appreciated in those late 90s seasons. But Duncan at seven, I think maybe to start is, why is he a little bit higher than Garnett? And, you know, I'll give you the floor again to just talk about what it was that made Tim Duncan so awesome to be at that type of level, where, again, I think some people wouldn't have him this high into the top 10, although I certainly would.
Well, it's interesting. My little note next to Duncan on the list here is opposite situation of KG's, which is what you, yeah, which is what you open with. But I also think that's what makes them, to me, and I'm biased because I grew up and watched their careers. This is what makes them the greatest comparison in NBA history. There's so many similarities. There are some differences. And then the whole thing, at least for the bulk of their prime, took place in these opposite situations where Minnesota is the poster child of ineptitude. And San Antonio, I mean, what a franchise, San Antonio. Popovich and Robinson into Duncan and, you know, whatever it is, 26 yeah, consecutive. I mean, it's incredible.
You're getting two Hall of Famers drafting, you know, 28th right, and 57th in right, you know, 1999 and 2001.
Exactly. And so, you know, I always wonder, like, if you ran Duncan's career backwards, what would the narrative be? I don't mean the teams from the last couple of years. I mean during his prime, because there was some issues in 2009 and 2008 as his prime ended, and in 2007 Tony Parker got the MVP of the finals, which is kind of like the cousin of Paul Pierce getting the MVP in 08, even though Garnett was clearly the best Celtic. You go back to 2005, he really struggled from the floor against the Pistons. You know, we don't have to relive all the narrative stuff, but the way narratives build are fascinating, and these guys had these narratives build in opposite directions. I'm filibustering here because the answer is, depending on the day, I don't know which one of these guys should be ranked higher. I think they're that close.
I kind of like KG a little bit better, I think. I think he could translate over more. Well, I guess the only thing is that in an earlier era, you know, KG maybe couldn't have played center, and Tim Duncan probably could have played center in any era. Although Tim couldn't have played power forward, you know, in this era. Again, I realize you're not doing as much era comparison as I kind of like to do. I've got to add some kind of a value here on this show. So,
when you did the podcast a couple years ago,
yeah,
where did you have these guys?
Oh man, I can't remember now at this point. I'd have to, that was like a 2-hour show. I should probably go back and listen to it.
So, but I probably. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, a 2-hour show.
I think I probably had Duncan higher. I mean, a lot of this too is that, and I think it's also interesting when you talk about the similarities between these guys, they both kind of had these long post primes where they're underrated. I think Duncan, because he was ranked so highly to begin with, you know, people were talking about him as the Spurs' best player in kind of that second time period from 2011 to 2016 when he retired, you know, talking about him as the Spurs' best player, even, you know, towards the end of that, and maybe until Kawhi Leonard finally broke through, when, you know, it was probably Tony Parker by the end of that, and they had really more of an ensemble cast. You know, to me, Duncan was overrated, I felt, by most people towards the end of his career, where KG probably was still underrated after he had that injury in 09, because, you know, Tim Duncan still would post up every once in a while, and KG didn't really do as much of that. But, I think KG, you know, I like him better as a defensive player, just a little bit more versatility, a little better jump shot, a little better free throw shooter, better passer. And I think Duncan, a better post player, but I think maybe a little bit of an overrated post player, certainly a better rim protector than KG. But so I think just Garnett's, if they're similar value players, which I think most people would, not most people, but we would probably agree. You know, I like the additional versatility of KG just slightly more than I do Tim Duncan.
I like that you can see how easy it is to have a conversation that turns into an argument with yourself about these two players.
Yeah.
You're like, well, you know, I like Duncan in the post, but then actually you don't really want to run your whole offense through Duncan. And then, well, you could run Duncan at center and he's stronger, but KG's more versatile and you go down that rabbit hole.
Well, I think, though, it's time to move on and talk about another guy that you have higher. I think you're 8 through 5, all these guys you have a little bit higher. I mean, and I think probably the guys that you're higher than are Magic Johnson, Larry Bird. I mean, those are the guys who, because I think I had Magic at like either number 4 or number 3 on my personal list. And my list, I think, was not as longevity focused as yours, which and you're doing a little bit more of a numerically focused approach than I did. But yeah, I mean, so you've got KG, Duncan, and now Hakeem Olajuwon, Shaq is your number 5. You've got those big guys over Larry Bird and Magic Johnson. I think also there's just, because Larry Bird and Magic Johnson are perimeter players who had the ball in their hands, they're just kind of sexier. They're more in the consciousness. And, you know, they played on those iconic teams too. I think that's another reason why, you know, they get a boost from a lot of people compared to the guys we're talking about. But again, I'll give you the floor here on Hakeem Olajuwon, another fascinating player.
Well, before I get to Hakeem, I just want to sort of reiterate the sexiness thing here. Magic and Bird, along with Jordan and LeBron and maybe a few other guys we can talk about later, they're really the only smalls who I think are in the conversation for greatest seasons ever. So it's not like I have a stance that views Magic and Bird in a really negative light. They just, neither of them have the longevity of these players. And in Magic's case, really quickly, it was the fact that he came into the league so young, it took him a couple years to kind of turn into Magic Johnson. He's just given a total pass for that, probably because of his 1980s game 6.
Yeah, it was just assumed that he was that good all the time because of that one game. That's all people remember, especially when you go back to that time, there wasn't really much on TV.
Right. No one remembers that he set the turnovers record in a game, the game before in game 5. But for Bird, same thing. Bird came in old. He was like 23 in his rookie season. And yeah,
because he transferred from Indiana to Indiana State. And then he, you know, went through his senior year, so he was older.
Yeah. Well, if you haven't read, if the listeners haven't read Jackie McMullen's whole thing about how Bird got to Indiana State, and it's incredible. He like just didn't even want to play basketball at Indiana and hid away, and then it took him a while to get into the game formally. And then so he only had, you know, eight or nine great years under his belt. So they I think traditionally just get automatically lumped into the top 4, 5, 6, 7 players, and when you stack it up this way, it's these bigs that, and I say, I think in the postmortem, I talk about how height ages really well. And if we get to Kareem, we can reiterate that.
Yeah.
But it's like, yeah, all these bigs here. So Hakeem had tremendous longevity that really wasn't talked about. And in a way, he was the Garnett before Garnett, not quite as extreme, but he was saddled in a ridiculously bad situation in Houston. If I can rant about this for a second, you're looking at a team that was not very good at any point in time and yet made no key transactional moves for years. They did nothing. They brought no one in through the draft. It was before unrestricted free agency for a couple of those years. They had players getting suspended for drugs. The Twin Tower hopeful was Ralph Sampson, and his career was completely curtailed by injury. Don Chaney, the greatest coach of the year ever, I think, Don Chaney. Every time I watch a game from that season, I'm like, what is Don Chaney doing? And then you go, oh, he won coach of the year. I don't know what games they're watching.
He and Sam Mitchell in, what was it, 2000 2007, the Raptors. That's probably
the Raptors.
Those
season,
would be my two. Yeah.
Man. So there's a lot there with Hakeem that I think suppresses him in the general conversation. But he's really this guy out of all of these guys that we're going to talk about today, that when I look at him as a player, I look at his situation. You know, he wasn't traded. He didn't have a lot of roster turnover. It's like, wow, it's possible that he was even better than I'm giving him credit for. But it's also possible that he was too rigid. Like, it's hard to give players credit for personalities transferring well. Like, if he was put in a different situation, it's possible that he would have said, okay, no, I still need to get my touches. I still need to get my 30 points a game. Can we please have a four out system with a bunch of shooters so you can throw it into me and I can kick it out to them? Like, there's just a lot of uncertainty around Olajuwon.
Yeah, and it's interesting because his best years, 94 and 95, at least in the playoffs, those the years that they won, of course, number one, they did kind of have those systems. But number two, you know, what was he, like 30 and 31 there, or 29 and 30? Usually you would expect that a guy's prime years would be before that. So you would think, oh, he was probably better during those times. But, you know, again, they weren't really contending, you know, really until 1993. Again, after that 86 finals appearance, which was such a surprise. So you wonder of whether, you know, did he get better or was he just this good the whole time?
Yeah. And there's a lot of truth in terms of him being really good for a number of years. Let me just speak to something there about the peak. I think it's pretty clear that his best season was 1993. That was he improved his playmaking. He made a concerted effort to pass more. In interviews, he talks about trusting his teammates, and he still has the defensive motor. I think his defensive peak was probably 89 or 90. Physically, he was still just a monster. But a lot of guys have a late offensive peak, Nate, like Nowitzki in 11, or even Bird's best offensive season was probably 87 or 88. You see this pattern a lot with LeBron right now. You know, I'm not going to say it's his offensive peak, but the offensive game evolves. You learn the patterns, you learn the angles, your jumper gets polished, and what goes is your defense. And I don't think Hakeem was nearly the defender in 1995 that he was, say, in 89 or 90. But man, that offensive game was dialed in by then. And that's the indelible impression that people have. Hakeem absolutely faking David Robinson out of his jock.
Yeah. And I think maybe as a big as well, it's easier where you're not as reliant on athleticism if you're more of a skill game, the way Hakeem, at least towards the end, did. You know, that unblockable fadeaway jumper going to the baseline that he could get off at any time, the hook shot, all the up and unders where he never traveled once.
he had those for years. That was one of the things that jumped out to me in terms of doing film study on those 80s seasons. It's like there's a playoff series in, I want to say, 87 maybe, against Seattle.
Oh yeah, when he had like, you know, 47 points and 29 rebounds in one of those games.
Yeah, it's his averages for the series ended up like 40 and 20 or something comical. But he kind of had that offensive game since the middle of the 80s.
Yeah, and I think an interesting thing that you talked about with him is, again, you know, he didn't really play with the other great players. You know, Drexler came in, Barkley at the end, then all the way back in 99, Pippen. But those guys were not really, you know, on the level of a second true superstar as late in their careers as they came in to play with him. And he also wasn't necessarily the same guy by that point. But yeah, you wonder about the scalability that he has, because he never really even had that efficient of seasons. But and this is something we haven't talked about enough, we should probably talk about on your show, is, you know, how much you're waiting regular season versus playoffs, because he just couldn't be stopped, you know, quote unquote stopped one-on-one. And, you know, it was really hard. While he wasn't incredibly efficient, he's able to hit these really difficult shots and do that at a solid efficiency rate. And so you got to really, you know, if you really want to stop him, you have to double team him, and that opens things up. And so, you know, he's going to play well in a playoff situation. So you've got, on one hand, you know, a game that transports well into that playoff crucible, but on the other hand, he's not incredibly efficient and, you know, not really an outside shooter. You know, he's got to be down there on the low block, taking up space for other guys. So you wonder about his scalability at the same time.
The playoff thing is a great point. Maybe we should table it. But yes, a huge component with Hakeem, needless to say, is that if you sized up his regular season metrics, he would be a rung lower. And some of the stuff he's able to do in the postseason, what his skill set sort of affords itself to, is this ability to just barbecue different defenses in the playoffs. And I think he sustains a lot of offensive value there. But, and there's still a but, he never played on a great team. He never played with great offensive teammates. So there is that lingering question mark in the front of my mind. Like, how would he translate offensively? How much value would he sustain if you put him in one of these good situations like the 80s juggernauts had or whatnot?
Time was, you would have to pay thousands and thousands of dollars to get personalized instruction from any teacher, not to mention an incredible master like Gordon Ramsay or Annie Leibovitz. But now, with technology and with MasterClass, you can take online classes taught by the best in the world. I've actually done the Stephen Curry shooting class. That one is awesome. The quality of just the video is fantastic. Cinematic production quality, on-demand lessons, and you can only find this content on MasterClass. They've got now over 35 masters. Malcolm Gladwell on writing, Ron Howard directing, astronaut Chris Hadfield, and a ton more. New classes are always being added, and MasterClass is just a great way to either develop your passion or work on your career. Bob Woodward on investigative journalism. Yeah, might want to hear from him. He just came out with a new book in which he put those skills to use. And Dunked On listeners can unlock access to every single MasterClass for a year right now at the URL masterclass.com/capspace. That's masterclass.com/capspace. Unlimited access to over 35 world-class masters, all for one surprisingly low annual price. That's masterclass.com/capspace. Find out what that surprisingly low price is at masterclass.com/capspace and learn from the best in the world and let them know with that /capspace URL that you came from us.
Well, another guy, Shaq, who, you know, you wouldn't say necessarily is that portable. I actually, you know, you've got him at five. I want to talk about his defense first. What did you find about him defensively? Because, you know, he is the center. He's got to be the anchor of your defense. Not a guy I recall who played on a lot of great defenses, certainly in the regular season.
No, he didn't. It's categorically his weakness. I mean, that's the wart with Shaq. He was one of the few bigs ever who was a legit offensive juggernaut on that side. And when you look at his defense, first thing that jumps out is pick and roll coverage. He does not like to come out to the perimeter, especially as his career moved on. He's got a lot of poor instincts that he brought into the league. He would bite on up fakes. He was foul prone when he was younger. And he didn't have the greatest reaction time. You know, I talked about Garnett earlier as a T-cell, just bouncing around, ready to jump on invaders. Shaq is more kind of like a bear, and not in the Draymond Green nickname sense. Like, if he's in the lane and you come at him, he's big, he's long, he'll block shots, he's physical, he'll grab a bunch of boards, and that's where his value comes from. But he's not super mobile. He got lazy at certain points in his career. And I think in many ways, there's a relationship between his conditioning, his defensive exertion, and his overall value, which probably prevented him from being in the conversation for greatest player of all time.
Yeah, although he still was pretty damn good.
He's still pretty good.
And I mean, I think people just forget how absolutely unstoppable he was during his prime, and just that there was no way to deal with him. And then, you know, the other team, like, you couldn't get away with going small against him. I think actually more teams should have just tried that and just said, hey, you know what? We're not going to stop this guy anyway. So why don't we just go small and we're just accept that we're going to have to double team him. And then let's just kick his ass on the other end. Like, teams didn't really seem to ever try that. It was always like, all right, well, let's throw like Chris Dudley or Scott Pollard out here because, like, you know, our primary center is in foul trouble, as opposed to really, you know, trying to spread the floor against him and then just accept that you're going to have to double team. I think that's something that teams should just do more of anyway, is like, instead of just, all right, we're going to throw, we got to get this guy out here who's going to be an offensive liability because, you know, we need someone to guard this guy, but you're double teaming anyway. So why not just guard him with a worse player to begin with if you're going to double team? But anyway, that's an aside. So, but he, yeah, go ahead.
Do you remember the 2001 finals? Larry Brown tried that. Do you remember this?
No, I that was actually a period where I was in college. I kind of wasn't paying as much attention. Like, I don't really remember. And also just because, like, I wasn't interested in those finals because I just knew that the Lakers were going to win. The East was so, like, I remember the Western Conference playoffs from those years much better than I do the finals, because it was just, I watched the 2000 finals. That was actually competitive. But from 01 and 02 were just, I knew there were going to be massacres and I, you know, I had other stuff to do at that point.
There should be a governing internet body somewhere that gives you points for admitting you didn't watch basketball as closely during a period. I feel like that's a thing. That's got to be a thing. Anyway, the point I was going to make there was Larry Brown tried, I never forgot it. And you can still find the, I went and looked at how long he played the lineup for at some point. He ran Dikembe Mutombo with four wings for like eight, I think it was 18 minutes in the first two games in LA. So he had Iverson, Rajah Bell, Aaron McKee, and Eric Snow. And they ran this college style lineup at the time. That's what it was kind of looked at as. And they broke even for those 18 minutes. And I don't know how many minutes Shaq was on the bench for, but I kind of had the same idea. Like, you are in over your head against this guy. He at his peak was completely unstoppable. To your point, he employed like 15 or 20 Western Conference centers during the 2000s, guys that just had to come in and like lean on him and foul him. But that wasn't really an effective strategy. Yeah. So why not lean into the skid, go the other way? And I'm going to point to that 18 minutes of that 18 minute sample size as evidence that it could have been a good idea.
Yeah. Well, and even then, you know, they had Mutombo out there as well. You know, I mean, I wouldn't have said, hey, don't, you know, play all 6'5 guys, but, you know, and that, you know, maybe they could have gone with like George Lynch at center on that team or something. And just said, hey, you know, we're going to double and just try and be quick. That strategy gets a lot easier under the modern rules too, which I actually came in, I think that year, I can't remember if it was 01 or 02 finals that those zone rules first came in, but obviously
it took
teams a while to kind of adjust to that. All right, I guess we maybe, you know what we should probably do? Maybe we can, you know, we'll talk kind of more about these, you know, some of the system stuff, but also maybe we can just table the LeBron versus Jordan discussion for your show, because we're already like almost an hour in here. So we should probably just get through the rest of these guys. But, you know, I mean, we could spend probably an entire podcast just on Jordan versus LeBron, which would be a lot of fun. But Bill Russell, number four, again, a guy who you have him higher than I did. I think part of that is that I still maintain a little bit that, you know, offense is more important than defense, just because I think that the value of a replacement on offense is a little bit higher than on defense. But, you know, if you're going to weight those equally, Bill Russell, as I talked about on the show with Kevin Pelton and Royce Webb, you know, basically created the number one defense. And it wasn't just the number one defense. It was the number one defense, like by a mile, way more of an outlier when in an era, as you've noted, because there were so few teams, it was really difficult to create separation from the rest of the league. But Bill Russell at number four, I mean, I think some people would have him there, but, you know, your argument isn't like the rings argument that's, you know, very unnuanced that a lot of people have. It's, what is your argument then for having him at four?
Well, he's probably the greatest defensive player ever.
Yeah.
And his sustained defensive value, it was there from day one, and it was there till he left. Now, did he peak in the early and mid 60s and then come down as he aged? Absolutely. But that team was a defensive juggernaut, and they were a defensive juggernaut through most of his career. And when he left, that completely went away. That's a really broad stroke argument. But when you dive into something deeper, one of the things I've done this summer is develop a box plus minus version that goes back to 1952. And, you know, I've been trying to look at that to see what the insights are to the Celtics team. And it's kind of echoing the same stuff that we've expected or had before then. So for instance, defensively, Russell's box plus minus back then is right up there with the guys today, or ahead of them, depending on how you look at the minutes or whatever. So the short of it is you've got a decent offensive center, good passer later in his career. He was a decent offensive player when he was younger, and like an all-time level defender. And no, today I agree with you. Today, I think all the data shows that there's an asymmetry between offensive value and defensive value. Offensive value is a little more important. The top offensive players are a little better, but that's overstated all the time, Nate.
Like, yeah.
I have some study at the end of the series that compares them, and the difference between the best offensive players and the best defensive players is not necessarily what most people probably think it is. If the best offensive guys, say, are 6 points better than average, the best defensive guys are like 4.5 or something. So Russell, in his time before the three-point shot, playing 44 minutes a game, being a revolutionary, he was really the first guy to do that. He was a shot-blocking machine. He was horizontal as well. He was cerebral. That's what puts him.
This is a little bit of a non sequitur for what we've been talking about, but how good were his teammates during those? I mean, there's all these Hall of Famers that he played with, but you wonder whether some of them just became Hall of Famers because they were on a lot of championship teams. How good were those guys that he was with?
Well, a lot of them were Hall of Famers because they played with Bill Russell. A lot of guys back then were Hall of Famers because they get the pioneer boost. You know, there's 8 teams in the league and there's still 24 guys on the All-Star team. So you make 3, 4, 5 All-Stars and you have a sexy nickname like Easy Ed McCauley, and you can get there. Now I mentioned Easy Ed McCauley. He was on the team before Russell. He was part of the Russell trade, I believe, that brought him in as a rookie. So they had Cousy, Bill Sharman, and McCauley. Those were really good offensive players in 1956. So he comes to this team that was actually a pretty good offensive team when he gets there in 57. But Cousy and Sharman start to get old. By 1960-61, like, Sam Jones is really the best offensive guy. And it takes a few years before they have other, you know, good offensive players, especially for an era where there's 8 or 9 teams. Havlicek didn't really become Havlicek until later in the 60s. They brought in Bailey Howell in the last couple of years. But Sam Jones was the guy. And then all these other guys after Cousy and Sharman left were defensive guys. They were what we'd think of as like the 3-and-D guys of the, you know, early Spurs teams or something. It was Casey Jones, good defensive player. Zach Sanders was getting a lot of minutes at forward. Tommy Heinsohn's a big name, but he was just kind of a gunner for a number of years. It was built and structured more like a traditional team than we think of looking back at all the Hall of Famers.
Yeah, that's interesting. And part of the reason that I downgraded Russell a little bit was that their offenses weren't any good, you know, during a lot of that period. You know, they were very defensive oriented teams. And so, you know, again, without having gone back and watched a ton of his games, my assumption was, well, you know, how good could he have really been as an offensive player? And what's your reaction to that?
Well, do you want to play Time Machine? You mean if in a more modern game?
No. I mean, just at the time, you know, it seemed like he was pretty inefficient, and, you know, wasn't really able to shoot outside of 2 feet. So
slightly more than 2.
Yeah. Okay. All right. If he's going up for like these lefty hook shots from like 6 feet away, I mean, that's like, you know, what was that, a 35% shot or something back then?
Although I don't know, like, that shot was crazy. Yeah. For those who haven't seen old basketball, it was just totally normal to take lefty and righty sweeping hooks within like 15 feet of the basket. And the shot was literally phased out across the entire league. But if you go watch old film, you'll see these shots. They're really wild ideas.
Well, when you think about the fact that even when they're running an incredible amount back then, you know, 120, 125 possessions a game, and they're incredibly inefficient, to think about like what their half court efficiency must have been like back then. I mean, you just see these shots where they just like, you know, turn for a 15-foot hook shot and just like half the time they just only hit the backboard, like, or they're just like, you know, running along the lane line and then just throw up this hook shot that, like, I mean, and try and go off the backboard. It's like, it's just impossible to have any touch. I mean, they're probably shooting like in the low 30s in the half court, I would guess, as considering how much they ran, and that they still were only shooting, you know, 40% as a league at that time.
And you know what happened? You analytics guys came along and ruined the game.
yeah, that's right.
No more sweeping 30-foot shots.
Well, I mean, and that we should talk about this too. I mean, it's probably enough on Russell for now, just because we're kind of limited in time. But the fact that Kareem was able to make that sky hook at like the percentage that he did, I mean, you linked to this. I thought it was really interesting. A guy who went through, I think it was the 1983 playoffs, and just took a look at like what percentage Kareem was shooting on those sky hooks. And it was like, it was definitely like high 40s, at least, even maybe even low 50s, you know, in the playoffs.
I think it was in the 50s.
Yeah. Against like playoff defense. and you know, that was only a couple of series, but in his analysis, so he could have just been hot then. But I mean, that's like, to make that shot as a seven, listed at 7'2", many said he was taller than that, unblockable shot off of 1 foot from like 14 feet away from the basket, to make that at 50% is just like, it's ridiculous. And the fact that like no one else has ever been able to come close to making a shot like that at that kind of a percentage is just unbelievable.
I think because he was so good right away, so good in college, so good when he got into the league, all of the politics around changing his name, his personality, the way he was with the media. I think what gets completely undersold about Kareem is the fact that he's this like 7'2", 7'3", giant who was also crazy graceful and fluid and cerebral. And so he's just like, all right, I got this shot that's completely unstoppable and I can build my entire offensive repertoire around it, and apparently I can do it until I'm about 40 years old. And this like size and essentially athleticism and fluidity that he had for so many years, if you go back and watch him when he was younger, it pops. But we just don't talk about him like he's one of the like great freak athletes. But look, I was covering a game in 2009 at the Staples Center, and I was in the media room, and someone stepped on my like the back of my heel as they were walking by me, and I turn around, and I'm about 6'2", 6'3". I would be listed at 6'4" in shoes or something like that. I turn around, I'm looking at this belly button. I'm like, wait, why am I looking at a belly button? I look up, it's Kareem. He's like 13 and a half feet tall. It's completely undersold.
Yeah. And I mean,
that's my Kareem stepping on me story.
Everyone has one. But yeah, it's really remarkable. And I think, just so we have it, by the way, LeBron at 3, and this was actually before last year's playoffs. And I think it was your prediction that LeBron would soon surpass Jordan. And then same thing, Jordan at 2 and Kareem at 1. With the notation, I think, did you say that both Jordan and LeBron at higher peaks than Kareem Abdul-Montana?
Yeah.
to make a Saved by the Bell reference there that we did before the show started.
Not that we were sitting around like talking about Saved by the Bell endlessly.
No, it was only like 3 minutes.
Yeah, they had higher peaks. LeBron, after his 18 season, I moved up to number 2. And I think his trajectory, he's looking like he's going to have enough longevity maybe to get to Kareem, but we can discuss that in the next segment of this when we talk about LeBron and Jordan.
Yeah, and I will apply my completely unbiased analysis, having grown up in Chicago in the 1980s and 1990s, so people can look forward to that.
I'm looking forward to that. I think the thing that most people don't realize about this series is how weird it was for me to put certain numbers next to certain names. Like, even just thinking like, oh, I now have Jordan 3rd. That just feels weird.
Yeah.
And I think there's like, right, there's like the scientist in you that's trying to be true to the method. But then there's also the guy who grew up watching. I mean, I didn't miss a Bulls game once NBA League Pass was around. So it's strange. But we can talk about that in the next installment.
Yeah, I mean, and I do think, you know, the acknowledgement maybe that Jordan had the highest peak is still, you know, I think that might mollify some of the people who are just up in arms about that and just say, hey, you know what, like he played essentially from 85 to 98 and he missed 3 seasons during that, with 86 with the foot, and then you know, 94 and 95 essentially. So, you know, we're really only talking about a 10-year career, and LeBron, his longevity is unbelievable. The one thing that I, and this will be my last comment on this, but you know, I said when people were talking about, oh, LeBron is as good as Jordan, you know, when he was kind of finishing up with the Heat, he would have been 30. I'm like, all right, let's see where he's at when he's 34 or 35, because Jordan, to me, easily, you know, the best 34-year-old, the best 35-year-old ever. You know, I'm still playing at a level that's best player in the league. By that point, I'm like, well, that's pretty much unprecedented. Maybe Kareem did it a little bit, but I, you know, I didn't think that Kareem was on the same level as Jordan, you know, what he was doing with those Bulls teams in the finals, you know, in 1998. So, and now LeBron at age 34 was at that level last playoffs. And so, you know, that's why it becomes so much more of a discussion for me. I think it's a very legitimate one. But Kareem, still higher than those guys to you. And I mean, how good was he? I mean, we know that he was basically the best player in the league for pretty much every year in the 70s. You know, maybe you could say 77. You know, he got beaten by Walton, although he had a pretty good playoffs in 77. Had, I think, one year where he didn't make the All-Star team because he broke his hand punching Kent Benson.
Yeah.
But, you know, until probably, you know, 1980, you know, he's got a 10-year run as the best guy in the league. And then it, into that later point during those Lakers years, how good is he during that period? Because that's really the period where, you know, you're saying because of these years, that's why he's better than Jordan and LeBron at this point.
I think what's crazy, you could say that he still kind of had that prime, late prime thing going until like 1982. And then 83, 84, 85, 86, he still has, especially for that era, the way the game was played, he still has some defensive value with his shot blocking and his length. That's this whole like height ages really well thing. And so even though he can't move as well, he's still able to play a very similar role in the lane, which is not to say he's an all-league defender, but he didn't become a liability. He's still got some value.
Yeah, well, and people killed his defensive rebounding in that period, like the 83 finals. You know, he really got eaten up by Moses Malone. That's something that people talked about. And that was an era where defensive rebounding for a center was much more important than it became later on.
Right, but you also need to use context when rebounding numbers, maybe more than like any other numbers, get fuzzy. And when you've got the early Lakers in the 80s had a massive, once they had Rambis and Mark Landsberger, Magic rebounding from his position, like that was a rebounding team around Kareem. They didn't need that version of Kareem to grab 12 boards a game. So so you have that on the defensive side. And then offensively, what's crazy when you watch tape, it's like you can't even figure out what year it is sometimes. You're just like, oh, they throw it into Kareem. He's this specialized half-court weapon when the Showtime Lakers aren't running. And Kareem just kills people with the skyhook. And you're like, oh, is it 1986? Is he 40? Is he 41? So he's able to maintain this sort of like all-star level of offensive play. I think that's the simplest way to describe it on a pod for a number of those years into year like 17, 18-ish, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, and even, you know, the 1985 finals, think of all the incredible players who are on the floor in that finals, and he was the best player on the floor at age, I think, 38 in 1985. You know, not playing at quite the level to me of, like, you know, Jordan in the 98 finals, although he's 3 years older, because, you know, Jordan was really the only guy causing the Bulls offense to work at that point, and they obviously had a lot of other options at that point, but still, you know, the best player on the floor. And then I think part of maybe why Kareem's performance in the 80s, it gets a little underrated, is because he had kind of these high profile failures in some pretty spectacular losses for the Lakers against other younger big men. Malone in 1983, 1986 against Sampson and Olajuwon, where, you know, he probably was not as good as those guys in those series. And if you're talking about, okay, all right, now he's not the best center in the league, he's getting beaten up by these guys, you're probably missing, well, okay, there's still, you know, 27 centers in the league that he doesn't have that problem against. And then, you know, the fact that it still has value to be the third or fourth best center in the league in a center heavy era going into, you know, your 40s.
Exactly. I mean, I've heard that comparison. It's like peak Moses Malone, whatever that is, 1983 couldn't be too far off from it. And, oh, peak Moses Malone, you know, destroyed Kareem on the glass. First of all, the game is more than just one-on-one, but okay, so he's not as good as peak Moses Malone in his 14th season. And the same kind of thing in 86, he's still a really good weapon, but trying to handle Olajuwon and Sampson, okay, that's not the biggest black eye ever. I think a lot of what happened, you know, what we talked about earlier on the show with Garnett and Olajuwon, Kareem went through some of that himself in Milwaukee, when he went to LA, missing the playoffs a couple years in a row, the team falling short of ridiculous expectations. Even in Milwaukee, when Oscar Robertson left, you know, they just did not have a good year, but he also broke his hand. They were much better when he played. He does well in all of these kinds of historical estimations of plus minus and everything with the box score. So there was a lot of narrative, I think, that was brewing against him in those years. And the last thing I'll say there on the 70s is, boy, for a long time before I really went back and looked, I thought, you know, I think I'd rather have a Walton type in like 77, 78 than Kareem. And I've done basically a complete 180 on that. Walton's still great, but I think Walton gets this like boost that we give guys, Derrick Rose, Penny Hardaway, even guys like Len Bias who never get to play. We give, you know, he had one or two great years and we're just like, oh, he must have been one of the all-time level players. Yeah. And it's like, eh.
Yeah, I've railed about that so before. Sure. That it definitely is like you just like, because you want to like, we, especially now when there's like all this like film and data, like you still want to find a way to nostalgicize things, to be like, oh, there was this unknown guy that like, oh man, you know, you if this had happened, like the thrill of the unknown almost makes you overrate those players, like, oh, what they could have been, right. What this guy would have been, man, let me tell you, you know, what this guy would have been if only blah blah blah.
And then the highlight reel makes it worse. Like there was one about Grant Hill recently when he got into the Hall of Fame. Grant Hill was great when he was healthy. Like he was legit.
He's one of those guys who's probably, I think, underrated how good he was during the healthy period because he wasn't really on a good team at that point.
Right. But then what happens sometimes is people who forgot or never got to see this guy play might see a highlight and then immediately you have like, oh, so like he could have been better than Jordan? It's like Len Bias was better than Jordan. There's a lot to get there. So
yeah, and I think another reason maybe why, and again, I don't think I agree with you as far as like, I don't know that I would have Kareem or Jordan, Kareem above LeBron or Jordan personally. But you know, so
love when we
talk about, we can talk about that more, but at another time. But you know, I think the fact that Kareem really only won one title, quote unquote, on his own, you know, and that I think a lot of people think of those titles that the Lakers won as Magic's titles, and you know, Kareem didn't play in that clinching game in 1980. Again, you know, Magic wasn't that good those years, but he did have that one unbelievable game. You know, the 1982, I think Magic actually won finals MVP in 1982, if I'm not mistaken. And so I think there's an idea that those are Magic Johnson's titles when, you know, that's probably not really accurate. And then you talk about, well, all right, those Bucks teams, right? That 72 Bucks team is one of the greatest teams of all time, but they went up against a greater team and barely lost, at least in terms of the point differential over the series, to that 72 Lakers team. 71 Bucks team was unbelievable. 74, you know, they lose a really hard fought series to Boston. Then he gets traded to the Lakers and, you know, good luck naming any of his teammates for those first couple of years in LA. So
you mean you're not a Don Ford fan club member?
So yeah, I think that the fact that his best years really are almost kind of lost, and there's this, okay, yeah, he got his one in 71, and then, you know, he came in and you know, but it took Magic joining him before he was able to win another one, and so, you know, how good could he have really been during those times?
Right. I mean, it's a great rundown you just gave, because he actually played 71, 72, 74. He played on these monster teams. Then again, we talked about this earlier with Garnett, with diversity of circumstance. Then he goes to LA in 77, and he dragged that team. Talk about floor raising. I mean, they played at like a 50-53 win pace, something like that. You know, made some movement in the playoffs, and to your point, just did not have a great team around him. And then when Magic and fresh blood came in, he was clearly the best team in 1980, best player on that team in 1980. For my money, still the best player on that team in 1982. That's a lot of really, really good teams in the finals, or winning championships, or you know, having incredible results, that I think historically is just put in a black box and called the 70s and wrapped up and thrown away by most folks.
Yeah, and then also there's this idea that when they played the Blazers, that Walton really killed him in that series. I mean, that's what people say. I haven't gone back and watched that series. I don't know if you have. Have you seen any of that 77 West Finals? Was Walton just kicking his ass?
No. It was Walton. You know, I'm close to jumping into Walton's voice, because every time Walton comes up, I just can't help myself. But he talks about like how Kareem dragged him up and down the court, which is a bit of an exaggeration. But
that's from Airplane, right? He has to drag yeah. Walton and Lanier up and down the court for 48 minutes a night.
Well, there's some truth to it. They're both great players that had a great series, but Jabbar gets his a lot. Walton does his thing, but Walton's not going to score 30 a night like Kareem was.
Yeah.
And I would not classify that at all as Walton killing him.
All right. Well, I think we've done as much as we can here today, but Ben Sight, backpicks.com, and he's also started a podcast and a associated Patreon. So tell us about that a little bit before we depart.
Patreon is really, the idea was to continue to create content in a multimedia fashion. Wanted to try a podcast, and the Patreon really just supports the podcast, gives me time, equipment, etc., to be able to riff off. I it's still very experimental. Every show is kind of led with a different voice. Interestingly enough, the next podcast is about the Lakers, and it's introduced by Bill Walton. So
awesome. Bill is like one of the nicest men that I've ever met. He really is an incredible guy. I hung out with him for an evening just because a buddy of mine was potentially gonna buy season tickets, and so they like put Bill Walton in touch with him as just like a way to kind of schmooze with him a little bit, and so got to spend a night watching a game with Bill. It was pretty fun.
Wow, that sounds better than getting stepped on by Kareem.
Well, everyone has a watching a game with Bill Walton story, except you, apparently.
Yes. No, I would love to get one of those.
All right, man. Well, thanks. This was a ton of fun, and I can't wait to get into some more of these discussions. I mean, we could obviously talk about this for 10 hours, and maybe over the next couple of years we can. But this is great, and looking forward to talking again soon. Appreciate it.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me on. I hope it was as fun as the first go around for people.